Welcome back to the program as we continue for Saturday night across the Chorus Radio Network. We are going to turn our attention to international matters this hour. Later on, we're going to talk to an expert from the Institute for Asian Research at the University of British Columbia. Of course, we had some eye-popping revelations from the North Koreans in the past few days. We'll talk to Professor Paul Evans about that later on. But in the short term, we turn our attention to the Middle East and, of course, the potential for conflict in that region. And we're joined on the line by Dr. Jonathan Nitzan, who is a professor of political economics at York University in Toronto. Professor Nitzan joins us tonight from Montreal. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hi, good evening.
You teach political economics, and in our education systems, Jonathan, we have tended to separate the study of politics and the study of economics, and you don't see that as a particularly smart thing to have done. Why not?
Well, I don't think that I'm alone in this thought. In fact, political economy is something that was taught as a unified subject, more or less until the 1940s in the academia, and since then it was broken down into gradually into two different disciplines, and now it is completely separate. I don't think it's a good idea, because I don't think that society is something you can understand by putting things into pigeonholes. So the project to separate politics from economics is a very old project. It dates back to Adam Smith in the 18th century. And it has possibly a hidden purpose, and the hidden purpose is to prevent us from seeing the power essence of economics. And for that reason, I don't think it's a very good idea.
We have the book already, but officially this coming Tuesday at the York University Bookstore, your new book that you've co-authored, called The Global Political Economy of Israel, is going to be debuted here in Canada. It's already available in the United Kingdom and in the United States. This is an amazing work. It is thoroughly understandable and more thoroughly researched than anything I've read on the region in a very long time. You and your co-author, Shimshon Bichler, are to be congratulated for your work. It's just an outstanding book.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear that.
In one case, in the case of Israel, this whole business, and the reason I asked you about political economy, which you teach, and the fact that we have tended to separate the two as academic disciplines, this goes to my next question in the case of Israel, because they have always treated themselves as a kind of a special case. Because not only do they have the economic realities of living in that part of the world and all of the politics that go with being a democracy, they've also declared themselves to be a special case simply because of the essentially at-war situation the country has lived with since in inception in 1948.
Right.
And again, you point out in this book that that's not particularly a smart or healthy thing to have done, looking long-term.
Well, I think that it is a smart thing to do if you want to conceal certain things, if you want to understand what has been going on in this history over the past 100 years. It's a very bad idea. I don't think that the war, for example, is something that is foreign to capitalism. If you look at the history of military conflict, for instance, in Europe, it has been one of increasing intensification over the past 500 years, and this goes along with capitalist development. So war is not something that is by any means precluding an understanding of a capitalist process, and I don't think that Israel is by any way unique in that respect. Now, having said that, of course, every country and every region is unique, but to say that just because you have been isolated, for example, from certain economic relations with your neighbors, then that makes you unique, I think that this is something you have to conclude rather than assume. In other words, conclude after you have researched it rather than start with this as a preliminary assumption.
Back to your point about pigeonholing, because I think it's really important for people to get a handle on where you're coming from with this. Because if we tend to isolate the political group, the politicians, the civic leaders, from the economic group, the corporate leaders and the movers and shakers in the business community, as long as we keep those two apart, we are, I think, misleading ourselves, because the two are inextricably entwined. They work together almost, well, certainly every day, in many cases for a common cause, and yet tend to want us to think of them as separate entities.
Well, I would address this issue at two levels. One is the so-called personal level. If you look, for example, on this, the history of Israel, and if you look at the ruling class in Israel, if you accept that there is such a thing in Israel, which we do, the history of this ruling class suggests that the separating lines between these different spheres, such as economics or politics or the military, etc., are really false lines. They don't exist. There is a very, very tight sociological and family set of relations that exist between these individuals. So separating, for example, state from the economy is a misleading concept at the actual personal level. But there is a deeper level that I think this separation is misleading, and that is the very concept that we can talk about something that has to do with production as if it is economic, and something that has to do, say, with voting as if it is political. I think that both of them are political economy. In other words, take the example of military expenditure, for example. Military expenditure is a decision that is done politically, but at the same time, it involves so-called economic processes. So is this part of the realm of politics, or is it part of the realm of economics? In my opinion, it is the part is a process that is central to the social development of a society and has to be understood as such. So, if we separate it into pigeonholes, we don't really know what to do with it. Or take another example of corporate taxation. This is something that determines and affects to a great extent the processes of accumulation, the processes of investment, the redistribution of income, power in society. Is this a political process or is this an economic process? And if you take one concept after the other, and if you're ready to face the question, you end up with no clear answers. And I think the easiest solution is not to make this separation in the first place.
Why do you think it's been such an important priority for so many years to create that separation?
Well, it is an important priority, I think, for the ruling classes in a capitalist system, because the ideology of capitalism is based on the notion that capitalism introduces a form of democracy by the dollar. And if you argue that you have this separation, you can then take the further step and say, well, we don't want politicians to intervene in the process because they actually distort the proper functioning of this ideal system that they call economics. Now, if you investigate the evolution of this idea, which was distributed mainly from the Chicago School of Economics in the University of Chicago, I think that more than half of the Nobel laureates in economics come from this department.
Right.
This department was actually set up by Rockefeller Sr., used to be the founder of Standard Oil of New Jersey, later known as Exxon, and towards the end of his life, he said that this was the best investment he has ever made. It had no, you know, material return that could be measured, but it had the enormous return of actually concealing everything that Rockefeller has done, because it diverted attention to the idea of perfect competition and small units and no government intervention, etc., etc., where the history of Rockefeller is anything but that. So it served the purpose of actually blurring the reality. It creates a smokescreen that is pretty effective if you are doing all sorts of things that are not really sitting well with the ideology that neoclassical mainstream economics supports.
Jonathan, stand by, if you would, please, in Montreal. I need to take a quick station break. Jonathan Nitzan and more on political economy and the Middle East when we return on the Chorus Radio Network. Our guest in Montreal, Dr. Jonathan Nitzan, co-author of The Global Political Economy of Israel. And Dr. Nitzan and his co-author advance a few theories, and we'll get to these in just a few seconds, about what's going to happen to the Middle East, to that entire region, if the Bush administration proceeds, as it certainly appears it's likely to, with some kind of regime change, military aggression towards Iraq. But Jonathan, before we get to that point, back to Israel and its evolution, so we can appreciate where it's at and what role it plays in whatever Bush may decide to do. We talked about a special condition that Israel created for itself. And we talked about the fact that part of that condition was a state of being perpetually at war. But the other half of the special nature of this designation was the fact that much in advance of where many European countries, particularly Scandinavian countries, ended up decades later, Israel was very much a welfare state. So you've got this peculiar combination of welfare warfare state from which the modern Israel has emerged.
Yes, I'm not sure what is the question.
Well, how did it get out of that welfare state that it was so
right.
conscious about creating and so carefully created in the first place?
Right. I think that it might be important to understand that the process here is one of evolution rather than some sort of a binary jump from one situation to another or from one regime to the other. Israel, when it started and way before the foundations of the state in the turn of the century, Israel was founded in 1948, was built on the so-called socialist model.
Right.
Now, the socialist model was not followed for reasons that have emerged, for example, in East Europe. It was followed because the people who actually controlled Israel during the time believed that this was the most effective way of actually colonizing the region, rather than that they were very much socialist. Many of them were not socialist at all. In fact, they had no socialist roots whatsoever. They came from petty bourgeois background, etc. Now, what is interesting in the history of Israel is that this socialist, so-called socialist period, was functioning in a way as a cocoon for the emergence of fully blossoming, if you like, capitalist system. So during this period of welfare state, you had the state actually creating the conditions for the emergence of very, very large conglomerates in Israel. And Israel has become, in fact, during the 1970s already, one of the most concentrated political economies in the world. You had about five or six large conglomerates that dominated the society and the business processes almost entirely, when people still talked about Israel as a socialist society.
Excuse me for interrupting, Jonathan. Were these conglomerates state-owned or private or a partnership of both?
Well, some of them emerged as state or quasi-state institutions.
Okay.
Some of them were owned by the largest labor union, by the Histadrut, and some of them were private. And through a process of mergers and acquisitions, they grew very rapidly. And eventually, all of them, since the 1970s and finally during the 1990s, have become private for all intents and purposes. So
okay.
all of them were privatized between the 1970s and the 1990s. So we don't have really kind of a quantum leap from a welfare state to a capitalist kind of a neoliberal state. We have a slow progression in which these organizations emerge from within the state, pampered by the state, supported by the state, and eventually, in many ways, taking over the state.
And yet, the disciplines of economics and politics and the reality of day-to-day life of the citizens continued to separate the two.
Well, it's quite surprising. During the past year, I've been twice in Israel for extended periods of time, and I've seen a sea of change in the consciousness of many simple people that don't have really intimate knowledge in political economy. What they know is from the newspapers and from the radio and television. And I've seen a really profound change in the discourse and profound understanding that politics and economics is not are not separate. It's not that they that most people understand the intricacies of this combination, but there is a growing realization that there has been a myth here that was created, and this myth no longer holds. And we can see it not only in Israel, we can see it in the anti-globalization movement around the world. So I think Israel in that case is, again, not a special case.
Okay. John, let me take a station break here, and when we come back, we'll focus on the predictions that you and your co-author make with respect to what's going to happen if Bush and possibly Tony Blair and others begin this whole military business of regime change in Iraq. What's that going to do to the region? Our guest in Montreal tonight, Dr. Jonathan Nitzan, and we'll be right back on the Chorus Radio Network. Our guest tonight in Montreal is York University, that would be in Toronto, Professor Jonathan Nitzan, who teaches political economy at York and who is co-author of a brand new book, which will officially be released in this country this coming Tuesday. The book is called The Global Political Economy of Israel. And I know I'm not doing this excellent work justice here, Jonathan, but I must skip ahead in the interest of time to some predictions that you and your co-author make. And this specifically refers to the United States and possibly Great Britain and Canada, for that matter, others who are going to, within the next few months, it seems, cause military action to be taken against Iraq in order to effect a regime change, to remove Saddam Hussein. You and your co-author say a new Mideast war could trigger global inflation and soaring unemployment. Why are you making that prediction?
Well, if you look at the history of inflation and economic growth, history going back to the 1970s, inflation is extremely tightly correlated with the price of oil. So the rise in inflation during the early 70s, the rise in inflation in the 1980s, the drop in inflation during the 1980s, and the increase in inflation recently in the Western countries were all tightly correlated with the price of oil. If you move to measurement of production growth, the correlation is exactly the reverse. In other words, every time you have a massive increase in the price of oil, you have the global economy being hurt very badly. Now,
yes.
I know that I've said that there's no such thing as economy, but the level of production is hurt very badly, and the level of unemployment usually shoots up. So if we are going to have a war in the Middle East, and if that war is going to yield a massive increase in the price of oil, there is, I think, a very good chance that we are going to see, again, massive unemployment and increasing inflation at the same time. This is a phenomenon called stagflation, and we had this experience in the 1970s and 80s, and I don't see why this could not happen again. I'm not predicting it. I'm saying there's a good chance, if the history repeats itself, that we're going to see that occurring again.
Now, let's take this and put it in a Canadian context, if we might, because in our oil patch in the province of Alberta, an increase in the world price of oil is seen very positively as a means of more capital flowing to the producers, more jobs being required on the part of those who work for the producers, and it seems to be pretty positive on the surface. So, and yet you're predicting the opposite, inflation and unemployment. So how would that apply in a Canadian context to our own oil patch?
Well, I think that you're completely right. Those groups, workers, companies, and so on that are tied to the oil business are going to do very well. Even though the overall economy is going to hurt pretty badly, I think that the oil companies all around the world and other groups will actually benefit tremendously from the process. If you look at the profits of the oil companies over the past century, they were almost entirely explained by the price of oil rather than by the level of production.
Okay.
So there's no question that Western Canada, particularly the provinces that rely heavily on oil, are going to benefit from it. But if you take the aggregate perspective, many more people are going to be hurt much more badly. So on average, you're going to see essentially prices rising and unemployment soaring and growth plummeting. But there will be groups that actually will benefit from it. Some of them for no action on their own part, but some, the oil companies, the big oil companies, I don't know that they are entirely uninterested parties in this you know, saga in the Middle East. They have been involved in it in the past. This has been recorded endlessly, and we will probably find that they might be involved in it right now, but we will find about that maybe 10 years from now.
Well, now let's take a look at Iraqi oil. If this regime change is successfully completed, presumably Saddam Hussein will be replaced perhaps by someone like Karzai in Afghanistan, a local person with friendly ties to the West, that sort of thing. Who gets the Iraqi oil?
Well, I just read in The Economist last week that Saddam Hussein is trying to actually divide and conquer his enemies by distributing contracts to European companies. So, and there's a debate whether after a war, supposing there is one, and supposing Saddam Hussein is ousted, because remember, Bush's father tried to do the same thing, and he ended up, you know, fighting Iraq and not displacing Saddam, and it's entirely possible that Saddam is not going to be displaced this time as well. But regardless of who rules Iraq, the Iraqi oil itself is kind of a pretty limited in terms of production right now. It's about 3% or slightly more of world oil.
Right.
So the distribution of contracts to drill oil in Iraq, I don't know that this is really the major issue as far as the oil companies are concerned. The major issue is what is going to happen to the price of oil. Because even if you don't get a single additional barrel from Iraq, if the price goes up by 100%, you know, profit, your profit goes up by 500%.
Okay. Back to another event that took place just a couple of days ago in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Israeli Prime Minister Sharon flew in to have a conference with President Bush and his people, and they met the press, during which Mr. Bush announced that he was trying to convince the Israelis that should U.S. military action occur against Iraq, should Iraq respond as they did when his dad ran the show a dozen years ago with Scud missiles being fired into Israel, dozens of them, some three dozen, I believe, the Israelis would please not respond as they did during the Gulf War. And it appears, on the surface, again, at least, that Mr. Sharon, he didn't say, no, we'll play ball, no problem. But you got the impression that the Americans were certainly leaning on them to not respond if Saddam fires a few more Scuds into Israel.
I think that in military matters, the history of Israel is always tied with a superpower of the day. It was the case when France and Britain were important in the Middle East until the 1960s. And it was the case since 1967 when the United States has replaced them. And in all cases, I don't think that Israel ever had, you know, much room for maneuver on the bigger picture. It had room for maneuver in terms of what kind of tactics it's going to follow. But whether to go to war or not was never entirely open to the Israeli government because it was always backed by one superpower or another.
Okay.
Right now, it's the United States.
Yeah.
So Sharon, you know, the show is that Bush is asking Sharon to do this or that, and Sharon has some leeway. I don't think that Sharon has any leeway.
He pretty much has to play ball, and that's that.
Oh, there's no question about that in my mind.
What would happen, though, if prior to some outbreak of conflict with the Americans, if Saddam, who is unpredictable and not stupid, dangerous, but certainly no dummy, what would happen if he decided a preemptive Scud attack on Israel would be the thing to do, again, just to confuse and throw everyone off?
essentially enables the United States to align itself with, or enables the Arab regimes or some Arab regimes to align themselves with the United States.
Okay.
Now, if there is an attack on Israel, it could lead to one of two things. Of course, it can lead to Israeli retaliation, or it can give the United States all the pretext it needs to go on immediately into attacking Iraq.
Right.
So I'm not sure that this is really something that the Americans would hate seeing. In fact, they might be pretty happy because this will remove much of the objection to the war.
Yeah. Okay. Back to Israel and its immediate neighbors, Iraq not being one of the immediate mm-hmm. neighbors, and the ongoing tensions between the Palestinians and the Israelis. You certainly look at this extensively in your book. What predictions are you comfortable with in terms of how this is going to play itself out? Is Israel destined to be in perpetual conflict with the Palestinians, or do you think, Jonathan, there is a way to resolve this, which will eventually be found?
Well, I just must preamble this by saying that I'm not into predictions because I think history is made by human beings and they have free will.
Okay.
Now, I certainly think that there is a possibility for a settlement, but that possibility requires a social change. One thing that I said to my friends when I visited Israel is that Israel finds it difficult to settle its problems with the Palestinians because the Israeli ruling class has nothing to offer to its own citizens, or it has less and less to offer to its own citizens. Because of the processes of globalization, what you see in Israel is a massive increase in inequality, something that was unheard of. You spoke about the welfare state. Israel has now one of the most unequal distribution of income in the Western world, on par with Latin American countries.
Okay.
Now, this situation is one that creates real tensions within the Israeli society. Now, if you take this on the one hand, and you take on the other hand the fact that religion is winning the hearts and minds of poorer people on both sides as an alternative, because when desperation strikes, you look for some sort of a spiritual escape route, and essentially religion gives you a full picture or a full world view that you can kind of escape into. I'm not making too much of a point regarding that specific process here, but what I'm saying is that there is a time element here, and as long as the Israeli society doesn't come to grip of what kind of integration it wants to have in the region, what kind of relationship it wants to have with its neighbors in terms of the way society is organized, chances are that the conflict is going to deteriorate more and more to religious levels, and you see that on both sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians. So I'm pretty pessimistic as time goes on.
Jonathan, I'm afraid I have to leave it there because there's a time constraint attached to this
right.
program as well. Thank you so much for yours this weekend, and congratulations once again on this outstanding book.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Nitzan, PhD from York University. The book is out on Tuesday in Canada. It's called The Global Political Economy of Israel. Sure, it's not a grabber from the point of view of plot, but it's an incredible work, a piece of research. We're back, and we're going to talk about North Korea after these messages on the Chorus Radio Network.